Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If. Only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to another edition of your favourite podcast, Insane in the Membrane, with me, Rich Wilson.
Insane in the Membrane.
Hello, here we are. Thought I'd have a bit of a chat with you before we get into this week's episode. Not done one of these for a while. I've missed you, and I just want to say thank you for your continued support. We do notice, we do see that you're still there, still listening. And we want to say thank you. You are wonderful people. You are the reason we do this. The longer you want this, the longer we will do it. It's as simple as that. This episode, I will say, as soon as we started recording, because we're in a studio, next door, the flat next door, decided they were going to just smash all their walls down. So you'll hear a bit of that drilling and banging and whatever else was going on. So there's a bit of background noise. But that's the thing, life is happening around us, isn't it? So sometimes you can't avoid it. I know, like, old recordings in the past of old programs and that, and it had to be just this and just that, and I quite like it when the things are going on around. If it gets a bit much, then obviously, yeah, we have to stop things, but I think going on in the background, trains and things like that, it adds a bit of depth, doesn't it? A bit of life in, which it has been lately. So apologies for not having an episode last week. Just a lot going on at the minute, you know. I've got a little Bodie to deal with, and, you know, there's gigs and running around, and then producer Paul's got his stuff going on, and so we're trying to link up and get together. But it's difficult, but we're doing our best. We're working it through. We just had a staff meeting. We've ironed out some things, and we're gonna plow ahead. And producer Paul has managed to lift my spirits, because I get a bit. He's great. I get a bit like, oh, what's the point? Is anyone listening? And then he goes, yeah, they are. Come on, stop being a dick. This is this and that is that. We've got to keep doing it. So, good old producer Paul. I think everyone needs a producer Paul. And my lovely wife, Kate McGann. Ah, long-suffering. She's a good egg. She's been through it. And she's still there, plodding away, looking after the boy. She's smashing it. So, shout out to Kate McGann. Well done. And well done to you. And thank you to our patrons for your continued support. We really do appreciate it. If you'd like to become a patron, then do head to our Patreon page. It's in the membrane /Patreon, I believe it is. I don't know. Who knows? You'll find it. We'll put the links to this. And if you'd like to jump up and give us some of your support, that'd be lovely, because that helps us keep things going as well. You know, with the, there's always costs, isn't there? Everything costs. You'll find everything taking the piss a little bit at the minute. Not us, but everything's just. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're going to buy something, you go, really? I don't remember it costing that much to do that. So yeah, do you know what? I've got to stop worrying about it. Stop worrying about it. Focus on the good shit. You know, keep pushing forward, keep walking, keep doing your things, keep drinking your water, eat your fruit and veg, and keep going. That's all you can do, eh? It's all you can do. Although I just watched the remake of Roadhouse recently. Yeah, I don't know if you've seen it. It's watchable, but I don't think it's going to be troubling the Oscars anytime soon. But that's a great. Do you know, watch it. Go and watch it. If you're worried about the world around you and you need something to switch off to, go and watch Roadhouse. In fact, watch the original Patrick Swayze. Now there's a film. Go and watch that. Watch them both, and have a night off from all the shit in the world. Anyway, back to this week's episode. This week I'm joined by my old mate Nick Wilty. I've known Nick, God, blimey, since I was up the creek, which I've mentioned numerous times on numerous podcasts. This one, I've mentioned it on here loads of times. As everyone knows, if you're new to the podcast and you don't know, I used to be a barman up the creek in Greenwich. I was a barman there. That's where I started my comedy career. And Nick Wilty was one of the old guard down there. Like, he knew everybody. He was part of the furniture. You know, he was part of the Malcolm Hardy crew. And I've known Nick since then, and he's a lovely, lovely fella. And he's got some stories. I mean, we could have done probably a double episode just with him telling us his stories. He's lived a life. And I knew when I had him on, I was like, and I just know this is going to be a cracker. And it really is. We really talked about some things that we've never talked about on this podcast before. Like, really, I guarantee these are subjects we've never talked about, and it's quite something. And I just can't wait for you to listen to it. And nice one, Nick, for coming on. You're an absolute superstar. He's a beautiful man. There's going to be a bit towards the end where I don't know if this has been edited out. It might have been edited out of the audio, but the video, which is going to be on YouTube. Check out our YouTube channel as well. You'll see that Nick just dissolves into a massive coughing fit. It's normally me that does the coughing, isn't it? But this time it's Nick. And so that'll be in the video. That's the bonus extras for you. That's what you want. You want to see a couple of old men falling apart, coughing. Stay tuned for that. But apart from that, plain sailing. We had a lovely chat. So, you know what? Let's get on with the show, shall we? So coming up in a minute, it's Nick Wilty.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You know, the life you've led, like you've travelled the world, you know, you've done all sorts of things. It must give you plenty of time to reflect on the life you've had.
Well, yeah, I mean, I haven't been anywhere since COVID, but as you know, I've been 116 countries, you know, so for me, travelling is just part of my life.
Yeah.
I've slowed down a little bit, not because of me, because my wife, she's got a full-time job and just can't get the time off to go travelling with me, but somehow, you know, we ran the festival in Jakarta, she came out there with me, and I've been to Amsterdam with her and Poland and Jamaica, places. If I've got a gig in some nice place, then I'll try and get her along for the ride. You know,
yeah,
normally
nice.
It's just me paying the flights and she joins me and the hotel's paid for. And I did that with my brothers. I mean, my older brother, he never did it with me. He's dead now, poor son. But, I'd say, look, I'm doing these gigs in South Africa. I'm going to be out there for 6 weeks. Why don't you join me? The hotel's paid for. You get yourself there, you know. And my best mate, again, he's dead, but he came to Shanghai with me, Bali, Jakarta, you know, every time I got a gig in some exotic place, I say, look, you know, take a bit of time off. Accommodation's all sorted, and they probably throw you through, a few free drinks like they do in comedy clubs.
Yeah,
so effectively,
nice.
It's costing you just your flight money. And, you know, I try to get my brothers and my family involved. If I'm going to be there anyway, why not come out and join us, you know?
Yeah, lovely, lovely. But you've, didn't you meet your missus at a festival? Is
Glastonbury.
That right? Yeah, Glastonbury.
2008 it was, and I'd one drunken night with her when I didn't really know her. We're both friends of Glenn Tilbrook, you know, that's...
Yeah.
I went down on his tour bus, you know, God, I didn't drive in those days. I went down on the tour bus with him and set up my camp near there, and all his mates from, you know, Greenwich and all that area where he lives, Chelten area, all put their tents around, and there was this single girl there that I'd vaguely seen before. She used to go out with a singer, you know, guy... He's in Paul Young's band for a long time, you know.
Yeah.
And so we vaguely knew each other through music. But anyway, we had one mad night together, you know, drink and smoke involved. And then we went back to my tent. And I don't know what happened, but I asked her to marry me next day. And she said, I love you. I said, I love you. This is ridiculous, isn't it? Ridiculous. So we had the next 3 days with no alcohol and no drugs, just to make sure it wasn't this sort of, you know, Glastonbury thing. And in a way, you know, it all happened spontaneously. First person I told, I said, look, I said to Glenn Tilbrook, I said, I've fallen mad in love with Maxine. He said, well, she loves you too, you know that. And we went to see him at the acoustic tent, and within 5 minutes, he said, look, I've got an announcement to make. I've got two friends out there. Come up on stage, you know. Nick's been my mate for 25 years, Maxine for even longer. He said they've fallen in love with getting married. So I guarantee now I'll be playing at his wedding, and let's all cheer for Nick and Max. It's like, this was 48 hours off we met, you know. And 15 years in, we're still going strong, you know.
That's amazing. That's amazing. It's a lovely thing. It's like my missus, we sort of fell for each other straight away.
Yeah.
And it's nice,
it's
isn't
lovely
it,
when it happens. You know, and I know, you know, obviously over the years I knew Jo Brand very well from back in the day, and then she had the same thing when she met Bernie. So that's the man for me, and that's it. And you know, two, three kids later, Charmaine Hughes, same thing, met her David, and just thought that's a, and I thought, nah, it doesn't happen like that. And then it did, you know. Yeah. I was 49 when I met her, and she was 39, and I'd obviously had quite a few girlfriends over the years, but. I was in love a few times, but I never felt like settling down. Marriage wasn't, for me, weren't on the cards. I enjoyed being a single man, you know, especially in this job where you're travelling around the world, meeting new people. And suddenly I thought, do you know what? It'd be nice to have the same person to go back to. And I like, you've got beautiful eyes. And I thought, wouldn't it be lovely to wake up? You know, and she opens her eyes and goes, that's my Max, that is. And that is still true to this day, you know.
Yeah, no, it's lovely. It's lovely. I remember your wedding, and we all had to wear something with leopard print.
Leopard skin, yeah.
Leopard skin, yeah, that was it, yeah.
Do you remember, I mean, some of them went completely the sound, didn't they? Do you remember Arthur Smith came dressed completely in leopard skin, didn't he? What's his name, the German comedian, Henning Venn.
Oh, Henning.
He brought a pet leopard on a lead. It weren't a real one, it was a stuffed one on wheels, but life size, you know. And it just, because when we met, you see, I had a leopard skin tent and she had a leopard skin dress, and it just sort of, it might have been Glenn Tilbrook, so you obviously could have a leopard skin wedding then. And I thought, well, actually, yeah, why not? That's your calling card. If you're dressing leopard skin, you're definitely one of our guests, you know.
Yeah.
It was in Deptford, so there were a lot of old slappers wearing leopard skin that came anyway.
it was just
a normal Sunday, yeah, for them.
Yeah, they didn't even know they were going to a wedding. They just rocked up. Like, where's everyone going?
Yeah, they just thought, well, I've got leopard skin. I might as well go wherever they're going. We'll
go with them. That was a good day. It was a lovely day. Yeah,
it was. Yeah. Do you know where it messed up? And it was just an oversight on our part. We had a budget for drinks. I think it was about $2,000 or something. And that all went very quickly because there was, about 400, 500 people there at various points. So we had a separate thing in a pub down the road. I don't know if he came down. I've forgotten the name of it now, in Deptford. And again, we put a budget behind the bar and said, when that runs out, they've got to stop paying for their own drinks anyway. Mm. At the end of the night, everyone had gone, and we were just sloping off back to our hotel, and this bloody barman chasing us down the road. Oi, you got to pay the bills. And no, we always gave you the money up front.
I think
$2.50 behind the bar for the after drinks, you know, and the food and whatever. And he went, no. Everyone dressed in leprosy has been drinking free all night. I went, well, we didn't say that.
Oh,
we said up to anyway. So the money we'd raised for the wedding, I thought we had 800 quid spending money for our holiday in Jamaica. And we had 120 quid by the time we got to Jamaica.
Oh, it
was
shit.
That bar bill, you know.
But, mate.
In a way, it made it a more interesting holiday because, you know, we were very lucky. Someone in Greenwich was a white Jamaican, lent us his house out there that he'd never actually lived in. He had it built. He said, you can be the first people to stay there. He said, there's a sort of a handyman there. If you'd slip in a few bob every now and again, that'd be nice. But other than that, it's free. And we rented a car off this guy's mother, old wreck that kept breaking down. But anyway, so they realised within 2 days of us being there that we were as skint as locals. I mean, we were bartering over vegetables in the market. They can't pay that amount, you know.
Right, yeah,
and people come by, for, you know, white people living in a posh house on the beach. They must have loads of money. So they come knocking on the door trying to sell us fish and stuff like that and say, honestly, we can't afford it. Well, honestly, we're living on about £10 a day. We just can't afford it. And then they saw us down the market and would you believe it, the next day, the fishermen were leaving fish for us, you know.
To
the
poor white mate.
They called us the pinkies. You know, leave some food for the pinkies. They really can't afford anything. And it's true, you know, we used to buy all our beer warm out of a Chinese supermarket and then buy some ice off a local bar. And, you know, we could have 6 cans for the price of 1 beer in the bar. And they realised that. So people started buying us beers, you know, and treating us as locals. It was brilliant in there.
Oh, mate. See, it's nice that. It's easy to think that the world is... Everyone's... at each other at the minute, especially now. But there are good people.
There are good people. I mean, this is my experience. You know, I hitched up around the world for 8 years before I did comedy. And I'd never had any money. I'd sort of earn enough money in one job to move to the next country and then want to run out and get another job. And I found the nicest, most generous people were the poorest people, you know.
Yeah, every
people
time.
People in India and Indonesia have got absolutely nothing. Would realise that I'm sleeping on the street and I'm, you know, I'd always go in a restaurant or something, you know, and shave and wash and look respectable. But, you know, I'm thinking, how do I get to the next town or how do I eat today, you know? And I would, you know, I'd see an orchard or something and knock on the door saying, can I take some of your fruit? I'm really hungry. And people were very generous to me, you know, people used to take me home and I'd meet their families and they'd say, stay as long as you like. And, you know, and they were the poorest people on earth and they just treated me because I'm, you know, an ordinary white guy, but I was skint because I wanted adventure, you know. They could see straight away, this is a man, you know, who's hitchhiking in Indonesia. You obviously haven't got enough money because it only costs, you know, for £2 you can go about 100 miles on the back of a moped, but I haven't got £2 to spend.
Yeah.
So I'd be hitchhiking.
Bloody hell. But where does that come from, that need to keep moving, keep seeing stuff?
Well, I had my upbringing was a bit strange. My mum and dad ran a pub, but you know, the summer holidays, you know, you're 6 weeks off from school. We always used to have a Volkswagen. It was a different one every year because my dad used to buy one of his dormobiles, he used to call them, you know.
The
camper vans. He'd buy one of them, do it up, we'd spend the whole 6 weeks. He would drive till half the money run out. Or half the time, whichever came sooner. And then we'd come back by a different route. And we did this every year. So by the time I left school, you know, 16 or whatever, I'd been to about 20, maybe even 30 countries in Europe, places nobody went to, you know, Poland and Yugoslavia when they were communist. And, you know, we were in Spain in the late, I was born in 58, but we were in Spain in the sort of early 60s in places that were unheard of, Benidorm and Lloret de Mar, when they were just fishing villages. But my dad would, you know, he was quite a drinker. He was a pub landlord. He would find his favourite bar, and that's it. That's where we're going to go. And us kids, you know, basically put up the tents and whatever next to the Volkswagen. My mum and dad would go down a pub, we'd amuse ourselves, you know. But strangely enough, my brothers didn't get that. I mean, I remember when I was 11, I think it was, it happened to be my birthday, and we were on the Rhine on one of these from boats goes down the Rhine. And my dad said, you're 11 years old today, son. What do you think you'll be doing in 10 years' time when you're 21? And I said, I don't know what I want to do, Dad, but I'm going to be like that lot. And I pointed to, there was a hearse painted in psychedelic colours. So this would be 1969, sort of proper flower power. I said, I want to be like that. Look at all them beautiful girls and all them men with beards. They all look so happy. That's what I want to do. And here's the irony. When I was 21, for reasons I don't want to go into right now, I was in the bloody army. My birthday was in Germany on the Rhine. I wasn't based there. I just happened to be on exercise there. And I thought, this is not the way I saw my life, being a bloody soldier in Germany.
Yeah.
On my 21st birthday. But again, that's because I'd spent all my money. I don't know if you probably didn't see my show in Edinburgh, but I did a thing about the Falklands. And in that, I explained how, you know, I had a road accident pretty much 10 days after I left school.
Yeah.
And the money I got was the equivalent of about 35 grand. It was a lot of money. Oh, it was a very bad accident. And so by the age of 18, there I was in Las Vegas. And I lost a whole lot in one day playing roulette, you know.
Oh, God.
35 grand. So I couldn't travel as much as I wanted. I stayed on that trip. I was on the hippie bus going around America, Canada and Mexico. And then I managed to rustle up. I borrowed 59 quid, which was how much it cost in those days to fly to Europe. And the only flight I could get was Brussels. So I thought, well, I might as well go around Europe. And there I am. I'm suddenly 20 years old, got no money, no trade, no qualifications. And I just wanted someone to pay me to travel. And I tried everything, merchant, navy, airline stewards, you know, all these things that sounded good. And in the end, the army was the only one that was going to pay me to travel. And it worked, you know.
12
in 6 years. And, you know, I'll get a pension now, mate. So, you know, off the arm. I'd live this old, you know.
No. But did it surprise you when, because obviously a lot of people join the army, but you don't really expect to go to war. Not really. But...
Well, when I joined, there was no wars. You know, I joined in 78. You had Northern Ireland, but I was never going to go there because when the job I had, I was in the Royal Signals, sort of intelligence work, Morse code and all that, you know. And they do that, what they call positive vetting, and they found out straight away, nah, he can't go to Ireland. All my mates were Irish.
Right.
Love them on the, you know, the provisional side. They just, I was brought up in a town in Dartford in Kent, had a lot of Irish people there. I went to school with a lot of them, and some of these people are still on the run now. So they knew that if I'd got sent to Ireland, I'd be target number one, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone knew me in that town. My dad was a pub landlord, all the other pub landlords were Irish, you know, it was just that sort of community. So I knew I'd never go to Ireland. In fact, they told me within, I think, 18 weeks of training, they said, do you realise you can't go to Ireland? It wouldn't be safe for you, are we? Well, as long as I go overseas, that's all. I don't want to be based in England or Germany. That's all I want to avoid.
Yeah.
So, you know, but there was no wars.
No. And
I mentioned it a bit in the show I did in Edinburgh. 4 years in, 4.5 years in, I was a bit bored with the army, you know. I'd been in Belize in the jungle, I'd done Arctic survival, been, you know, another 10 countries in Europe, you know. I was having a good time, but I thought, I just want something to happen.
Yeah.
And I remember I was talking to my older brother Dave, and I said, you know what, I wish would happen. This was in March 1982. I said, I wish there was a little colonial war somewhere. You know, what I had in mind was Bahamas or Bermuda, you know. some, you know, Cubans or something invade it. We go off and, you know, get to see action, and then it's all over very quickly. And I'd say, well, I saw a bit of action. It wasn't my cup of tea, but at least I know what it's like. And, of course, a month after that, the Falklands invaded, and because I like travelling, I knew exactly where it was. I thought, that's South America, that is. That's bottom end of South America. I volunteered for it. I rang up my officer, actually, Mr. Couch, and volunteered.
Oh, did
and
you?
He said, oh, there won't be any, that won't, it'll all blow over in a few days. And of course, the very next day, April 2nd, 1982, full on invasion. And he called me and said, right, back to barracks, you got your wish, sunshine. And that's it. Even then, I thought they won't fight us. It's going to take us 4 weeks to get down there, you know. By which time they would have all, they'd realise, you know, we outnumber them, we're all professionals and that. And of course, it wasn't the case. They outnumbered us by quite some. And
Really?
Well, even by the time we set off as well, we sailed from Devonport. By the time we set off, they'd already sunk, what, four of our ships. And thought, this is really happening. This is really happening, bloody thing. So I got my wish. I saw action, you know.
How did you feel when you, because it's the thought of it, and you've trained for it, obviously.
Yeah.
But obviously the thought of it is different from the experience of it. So when you get there and you see, oh, shit, we're a bit out of our depth here.
Oh,
we've underestimated them.
Well, I won't give too much away about the show because I might be putting it out on Prime Video or something soon, but I had it all filmed. But, I mean, I was under friendly fire when I first landed and we got sent back to our ship. And the next thing that happened was we liberated the airfield, and then I watched a horrendous friendly fire incident. Our guys, Harrier shooting at our guys, and I was there watching it happen. And then, you know, I had to kill a bloke and in a trench with a bayonet. That these are things that even a trained soldier doesn't think you're ever going to do.
No.
So I came back. I thought, well, I always felt all right.
Yeah.
But I became a strange person. I know it now. I didn't know it at the time. But I then used to go around the world for 8 years and had lots and lots and lots of girlfriends and jobs. But I couldn't tell anyone what I'd been through, and it took me nearly 40 years to talk about it, and then I did it all in one go in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
28 nights, or 28 afternoons, strictly speaking, but I did that show 28 times until I go, yeah, that's what I did. I can say it now. I still broke up. My voice would break up sometimes, and that's why I got into the habit of this breakfast wine. My show was at 1 in the afternoon, and there's bits in the story where I know where it's going, and I know it's quite disturbing for people to hear. So I say, so anyway, I was in this trench one afternoon, and you know, this thing happened. But by the end of it, I thought, I realised what I'd done. You know, it's hard. I never told my family these things. Mum and dad are both dead, and I never got to talk to them about it. My older brother is dead now. When I did the show, the one I filmed in my hometown in Hastings, Whitstable. Sorry, my wife's on the phone. I won't answer it. I did it in Whitstable, and that was cathartic. I mean, of all people, my wife was there who hadn't heard most of these stories. Glenn Tilbrook and his wife were there.
Right.
My brother, his son, neighbours. People who, you know, that knew I'd been in the Falklands because I haven't hidden it, you know. I've been open about it for 20 years. I just didn't go into details.
Yeah, when I met you, the first time you'd mentioned it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, 2007 is when I got sort of forced into talking about it in a way. I don't know if you know this story. I was in New Zealand, in Auckland, with Sean Mio. And he's into... you know, action films and war movies, and he collects stuff, you know. And he said to me, just walking around Auckland, down in a place called Devonport, down the docks there, and he said, have you seen that film Private Ryan? And I said, yeah, I did, yeah. He said, yeah, I think it just come out then, around about that time. He said, yeah, I saw it in a cinema with surround sound in the afternoon. There was no one else there. I was sort of on my own. He said, and I actually know what it feels like to be under fire in a landing craft. And I said, Sean, you don't.
No.
You really don't. And he said, what you do? I said, yes, I fucking do. And I told him my story of coming in a landing craft. It turned out it was the SAS trying to kill us, but whatever.
What?
It was friendly fire. They didn't know we were coming. We didn't know we were there. But this horrendous incident where we're in a landing craft and suddenly we're being fired at and we call in fire onto the people firing at us, and at that moment word come through blue on blue.
So
I told Sean Mio that. He went, fuck me, I didn't know that. I said, yeah, well,
see, that's it. If you don't know who's in front of you,
I would never have spoken about it. It wasn't something that crops up in conversation.
No.
But when Sean said that, he said, I know exactly what it's like to be under fire in the landing craft going into beat. I said, you don't.
No.
You have no idea. Watching a movie does not give you any idea what it's like. The fear and the tension and the, you know, starting to think about things that you're never going to see again, and what happens if I don't make it, and, you know, da-da-da.
Yeah.
And my best mate who was with me, who features in the show quite heavily, called Heapy, we were coming in and there's bullets flying and mortars going off. It was bloody horrible. And he was right in front of me and he turned around and he said, if I don't make it, will you tell Anna Lover, which was the girl he'd married about 2 months before, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm fucking hell. He's starting to wonder if he's going to make it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And he was in the same helicopter crash as me. That's why, you know, he crops up in the in the Falklands show a lot, because he was we joined the same diner. But I in my head, I suppose blokes do this. You can't compartmentalise it.
Mm.
I don't need to talk about this shit. No one needs to know it. It's been and gone. I didn't think I had a problem with it, but the first one who noticed something was wrong with me was Mark Thomas, you know. Just, you know, I think a year after I started comedy, 90 or 91 or something, I won this award called the Polarman Award.
Mm.
And Mark Thomas was a compere and presented me with this prize, you know, and it was quite a, you know, chunk of money. Plus, I'm going to be on radio with Craig Charles. That was the prize.
Lovely.
You know, anyway, you know. So Mark said to me, what are you going to do with it? I said, well, I haven't had holiday for years, you know. All my travels up till then, it was a long-term working holiday, really. I'd like to just go somewhere. He said, what have you got in mind? I said, well, I'm going to go up the pyramids. So I'm going to go down the Nile on a felucca. I'm going to go to Luxor and all these places. He said, wow, guess where I'm going to be for Christmas? Egypt. So I said, well. So we arranged to meet up there. And cut a long story short, he was there with his wife, Jenny, and I was on my own. They were in a nice hotel. I was in a cheap hotel, like a backpackers thing. But I was out doing my thing, and we'd catch up in Cairo and, you know, do the pyramids together and whatnot. And at the end of it, he said to me, can we have a quick chat, Nick? He said, you need to talk to somebody about your PTSD. And I said, what are you on about? What are you on about? Mark, explain it. He said, right. Every time we were together at sunset, didn't matter where it was, out in the desert one night on camels, another night we were in the city of the dead, he said, something happens to you at sunset and you go all a bit weird and start talking about you got to keep low, you got to dig a hole. And all that. I said, didn't. He said, Mark said, you didn't. He said, I wrote it down. He said, every night we were together at sunset, you'd say these weird things. We need to get low. There's no trees in the desert, so we need to dig a little hole and things like that. And I said, sure you didn't do that. And he said, you did. You ought to talk to somebody about it. And I didn't, but I thought, maybe I did say that. Yeah, because in the Falklands world, it was sunset when everything kicked off, you know.
Oh, really?
During the day, you'd be digging trenches and eating stuff, getting ready for night manoeuvres. And then as soon as the sun goes down, the first bullets start to fly, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, blimey, I didn't know that. And then I had a girlfriend at the time, a very beautiful girl, and she left me over it. She said, you're obsessed with this thing. She said, you're all weird at sunset.
Oh, God.
I don't know what you mean by that. She said, we'd be walking down the street, and as soon as the sun goes down, I said, right, we better keep to the walls now.
Wow.
And I was sort of protecting her.
Yeah.
I didn't know I was doing it. To me, it was my normality that you just at sunset be very wary, you know, don't be a silhouette on the horizon. Don't be under a street light. You know, keep away from traffic because, you know, this is when it's all going to happen. And I probably should have talked to somebody about it, but I didn't because I was, you know, being a decent act, funny bloke. Yeah. I was getting my kicks out of life by being funny and travelling. And this little private demon was my thing. No one needed to know about it, you know.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And that's it. But back then, we didn't know about these things. Not really. Well, it's only been in last, you know, few years.
Oh, yeah. Well, really, it's been since the guys came back from Afghanistan and Iraq, you know. I mean, back in my day, you've got to remember, 82, so we're talking about 42 years ago. There was no thing as PTSD. They just said to me, how are you? I said, well, I've got a broken shoulder, but apart from that, I'm all right, you know, after this helicopter crash. And then they gave you what? You get priority leave. So the moment you get home, you can have all your leave if you want. So I had five weeks in a row on leave. And then you get your dream sheet comes true. You pick places you'd like to go, and they sort of bump you up a little bit because you've seen a bit of action. You get what you want. So I'd put in for things like Hong Kong, Singapore, Gibraltar, Belize, you know, the tropics. That's where I wanted to be. And they sent me, I'd already been to Belize once, but they sent me back to Belize. So, you know, they sort of looked after you in that way. But no one ever said to me, you're actually all right.
No.
And it's funny, when I talked to my friend Heapy, who I couldn't find him for 36 years, because what didn't occur to me, he stayed in the bloody army.
No.
Yeah. So we met up at this helicopter we crashed in, and I did a little bit of filming there, which is incorporated into the Edinburgh show. And after it, we hadn't seen each other for all these years, but we sat in my little camper van and we talked through all these things that I'd been through with him. And he went, yeah, that's how it happened. That's it, Nick. He said, you know why why it still gets you, Nick? He said, because I stayed in the army. He said, I was many a time around a campfire and I might have been the only Falkland veteran there. These guys might have been in Iraq, Afghanistan, which he also served in, by the way.
Yeah.
But then he'd tell it these sort of stories. And they go, fucking hell, you've been through a lot. He said, yeah. I was able to talk about it and they pat you on the back or even cry on your shoulder. He said, then it's over. He said, you never did that, did you? I said, well, who could I talk to? Who could I talk to that would possibly understand, you know? You know, it makes me think now, you know, back in the day when I was hitchhiking around the world, I used to sleep in graveyards at night because no one goes there. But I'm not.
Yeah.
It scares me, you know. And I never had any fears. And I did Richard Herring's podcast the other day. And I don't know how it came up. But anyway, so what was the scariest thing ever happened to you that you've dealt with? And I told this story that I'd never really told anyone. And I was hitchhiking around America. I'd only been out of the army about 3 months. And there I am hitchhiking from New York down to a place called Hackensack in New Jersey.
Right.
And this guy pulled a gun on me. And he said to me, are you packing? And I said, of course I'm packing. He got my backpack. He went, packing. And he pulled out his bloody great gun. It was a Colt 45. And here's exactly what I did. And I'm so proud of myself. I just thought, inside, I'm absolutely, oh, my God.
But on
the outside, I looked calm. And I said, you've got the wrong gun there, mate. That's a Colt 45. He said, I just got out of the army, by the way. I know all about guns. You've got the wrong gun there. So if you shoot me, the whole side of the car's going to come off. It'll make such a blast. And we're at the side of the motorway. We've pulled over on the interstate, you know. I said, what you need is a little Colt Python or a Browning 6mm. I said, give me that gun and I'll show you what I mean. And he went, well, I said, give me the gun and I'll show you what I mean. And he actually gave me this bloody great Colt 45. And I did exactly what I said I was going to do. I said, look, I'll show you. I said, look, I'm aiming now. If I aim, say, through the window now, I said it'd take the whole of the window out. There'd be all sort of debris in here because it's such a powerful gun. Get yourself a nice little Browning 6mm. That's what I'd recommend. Or, you know, a Colt Python would be the ideal thing for you. Now, I'm going to get out of here, mate. And, you know, have a good evening. He called himself Joe Mango. I said, Joe, have a good life, mate. I'm going to get out of here. Just bear in mind, nobody with money or possessions would be hitchhiking at night. So, you know, don't pick up hitchhikers. We're just trying to get from A to B. I'm trying to get to my girlfriend in Florida.
Yeah.
Completely made up, of course, but I wanted them to know I'm straight and I'm expected. So I said, no, I'm going to get out of here. So look, I'll just get my backpack and then I'll give you a gun back. All right, Joe. And I gave it to him, handle first, and said, right, have a good life, Joe. Honestly, don't pick on backpackers. We've got no money.
Yeah.
See you later. Have a good life, Joe. And he drove off. And then I sat and cried for about an hour.
Jesus Christ.
And I walked into the nearest police station. It was about 2 miles further up the road. Yeah. And I walked in there and told them what happened. Told them the name, the type of vehicle, as best I could remember, the number plate, you know. And they said, how did you find out? I said, well, I was hitchhiking down in the States. It's illegal to hitchhike. And it's a very foolish thing. I said, my instinct told me not to get in, but I needed a lift. And I really, you know, just thought you ought to know there's a guy out there with a gun that is going to kill a backpacker one of these days. Just thought you ought to know, you know.
Yeah. Wow.
So, mate, you know, and that's what the army did for me in a way. Even though inside, I'm, oh, my God, this is horrendous, I was able to look calm on the outside and say, right, you know, and think it through. What is the best way to get out of this? How am I going to get out of this without getting killed?
Yeah.
And of course, I then, you know, I'm playing with Jeremy podcast. It went down quite well. So then he said, is it true you got lost at sea once? I said, yeah. You know, off the coast of Africa, yeah. With the chairman of Pepsi. So I told that little story. He said, you've had a hell of a life. I went, oh, mate, I could tell you. I've got about six horrific stories like that, that ironically are nothing to do with Falklands, just things that happened to me when I was a backpacker that I probably wouldn't have been able to cope with had I not been through that nightmare of a war. Because everything, you can put everything in perspective, you know. You know, a guy in Australia abducted me and held me screwdriver against my neck, made me drive 400 miles through the desert. It was going to kill me, you know.
Oh, my God.
And it was horrendous. And funny enough, when I lived with Malcolm Hardy, it all came back. They released a picture of the guy who abducted the Falconio couple. You remember that?
Oh,
Joanne Lees and Falconio. And I said to Malcolm, that photo, you know, the what they call it, the photo fit, that's the guy who abducted me. I know his name.
Fuck.
I know his name's John Stein. And I swear blind, within a week, the police were knocking at my door.
Yeah.
And said, we understand that you were abducted back in the 80s. And this guy looks at him and says, that's the man who abducted me. I'm telling you now, I can tell you his name. Fucking until the day hell. I met him, because it just happened to be Easter. It was the day after Easter Sunday.
Yeah.
So, no, whenever, not 95, whatever date that was, it was the day after Easter Sunday in a place called Broome, Western Australia. And I know his name because the reason I met him, I was behind him in the Dole office.
And he said,
John Stein. Anyway, I made an 18-page statement to the police. And that, by far, was the worst thing ever happened to me. By far.
How do you cope with that? I mean, because you just think you're going to die.
Well, he kept telling me, he said, I've killed before, I'm going to kill you. And what happened, we were trying to... The roads out in Western Australia, this is driving from Broome towards Perth. There's miles and miles, 400 miles between towns.
Mm.
And he had a mate in the car as well called George, who was just as scared of him as me.
Right.
He would hit him every now and again, he'd punch me in the face and he'd punch his mate in the face. And anyway, made me drive. I didn't drive at the time, but I knew how to. I just hadn't got around to driving. Yeah. You know, possible test, but... So I'm now driving his car through the outback down this big sort of dusty road, and a road train went to go past. You know, in Australia, the trucks. So this one was about, you know, it seemed like a quarter of a mile long, but anyway, had four or five big trailers on the back. And as it went past, it kicked up all this dust, and I saw it as my chance. So as it sort of just about to pass us, we're all covered in dust and shit, and I turned into it and hit the back wheels. Now, that meant that we were now wedged under the back of his thing. Now, the driver got out with a crowbar, and as he approached the car, he went, "You psychotic cunt." And I jumped out the window instead of being held hostage, and he pulled me out, and with his crowbar, he said, "You leave that boy alone. Get in a cab, son. Get it. You fucking stay in there, I'll kill you, you know."
Fuck.
And he rescued me and drove me, to the nearest town, which was about 200 miles away. Introduced me to the guy at the garage who looked after me. I then reported it all to the police, and I was able to tell him everything about this bloke. He told me he'd been tortured in Vietnam, so we know, you know, he special forces. He had all his fingernails were missing. They'd all been peeled off by the Vietcong. He'd been through an awful lot of trauma and was taken out on people. I'm an ex-soldier and foolishly was wearing a normal jacket, but it had a little communist badge on there. It was a souvenir from my time in Germany and East Berlin, where I'd swapped it with a Russian soldier. It was my little souvenir. No one knew that little communist badge. You know, that sparked him off, and that was it. Now, anyway, the long and the short of it is, they got the guy who killed Falconio, called Bradley Murdoch. He's still serving life. He's denied it to this day. He looks nothing at all like the photo fit.
Oh, wow.
And I had a phone call from the Northern Territory Police asking me if I'd come over and identify him as John Stein. I said, the man you've got is not the same guy. He can't be.
No.
Your guy's about 40. Now, my guy was already in his 50s, and it was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
This guy could not have been the one who abducted me. The one that has been described in the photo that you've given is my guy. The one you got doesn't look anything like him.
No.
And, you know, I think Murdoch himself said, look, I'm a nasty bit of kit. I'm a drug dealer and I've hurt people over here. He said, but I didn't kill that boy.
No.
To this day, he could get out of prison if he admitted that he did it, because he's done his time now. But he said, no, I didn't kill that bastard, you know.
Wow.
So I don't know what's going on. But, of course, I never went out to a Northern Territory because, you know, they found the man. But he looks nothing like the photo fit. And I'll do a whole show about it one day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's all very disturbing. Northern Territory police, believe me, and that the picture tallies with the guy who abducted me. Well, how come you've got this guy, Bradley Murdoch, who looks nothing like it and he's 20 years younger?
Oh, mate. So I can't handle stories like that. I can't watch these TV shows about people that have been wrongly banged up.
Yeah.
Because it just keeps me awake at night.
Well, I like that sort of thing. I'm not into fiction, you know. I like documentaries.
Yeah, same, but
I watch a lot of stuff like that because I sort of can relate to it, you know.
Mm.
But so it was quite funny when I did the Richard podcast, because it's in the Gulbenton Theatre. And I thought they were all going to be about, you know, who's your favourite comedian, what's your favourite story and that. But he went down that route.
Yeah.
I was on with Vic Reeves. Vic Reeves was on first.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was on second. And it, I don't know, it lasted about an hour and a half. And then I sell a lot of tickets for my own comedy club. That you know, about 20 people from the Gulbenkian came to my comedy night, you know.
Yeah, I bet they didn't all.
But I didn't tell any, you know, funny stories. I just said, you know, yeah, I've had a funny life.
Mm.
And this is why, you know, especially people say, oh, it must be horrendous dying on your ass at comedy. Yeah, it's not very pleasant, is it? But at least the way I quantified it is, well, yeah, but there's not going to be a sniper waiting out there, is there?
You no.
Have a bad show and boom, that's it, you know, you step on a landmine. So I can keep it in perspective. Obviously, I've died many a time. Everyone has.
We all have.
6,000 shows. So of course, there's going to be some bad ones. But I get off stage. Well, I tried my best. I did work last night. I've dug into my archives and material. It's always worked. It didn't work. What more can I do? You know, I don't ever sort of beat myself up over it. I go, well, you know, it seemed to work at the Comedy Store last night. The fact that it's not working in your little village hall, I'm really sorry about that. I tried my best. I remember what I was going to say. I said it. You didn't like it. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
But trust me, the next act's brilliant. Yeah, and I never blame other acts or the compare shit show. Just, yeah, I wasn't on Fortnite, and I'm sorry. I did try my best. That's how I quantify. I go, well, you know, I'm still going to get paid a couple hundred quid for what I did, even though they didn't enjoy it. I gave it my best shot, and I won't step on a landmine just because I was shit that day. You know, it's...
Yeah,
it sort of keeps me on the level there in that respect. Yeah, you know?
Must have been, because like you go back to what you were saying about being shot at when you're coming in, you're coming into wherever you're coming into, and it's coming at you. And like you said, we see it in the films, and they're all. But if you don't know where it's coming from, and you don't know what do you do? Just hide.
Well, you can't tell where it's coming from until the occasional trace of bullet comes. You know, in movies, you can see the bullets. You know, they're called tracer bullets. And what they're for is, once one person realises they've hit something, they fire a tracer bullet at it, so all the others go, follow my trace. So the first bullet hit our landing craft, they realise it's hit because they can hear the metallic sounds. Then the tracer bullets start coming, and then... You don't want to do trace bullets for too long because that gives away your position. So it's not like in the movies. The way I described it in a show, and this is how it seemed to me, it's very windy and cold. We're bobbing around in a landing craft. Mm. It was like a dart that's been thrown at you and it's just missed you in. What the fuck was that? And it's almost silent, but just the air rushes. And what the fuck has just happened there?
Yeah,
and then see a tracer bullet, and you go, that's what it is. So that's when you know that's what's going on. So it's horrendous. There's no gentle way of saying it. You're under fire, and that is it. You know, and I would wish it upon anybody. But we only had it the once, the second landing we had, we were unopposed. We didn't have any problems with that. Mm. And to be honest, the day after I got on land, the war was over, you know. So all I had was that one experience, and it was horrendous. There was no joy to be had. And it isn't like a movie, because you can't see anything. No, you know, you're in a metal thing that's camouflaged. You're all camouflaged and blacked up. We've got Hessian on our helmets. We're, you know, black faces. All the weapons are wrapped in Hessian as well, so they don't reflect or anything. And you can barely hear anything. I mean, Heapy, my best friend, was in front of me. I could hear him talk to me when he looked at me, but the rest of the time you couldn't hear anything. And like I say, you don't hear the bullets until they start hitting. They just shoot.
Fuck.
It's not glamorous, and it's, you know, I mean, Private Ryan or lots of films, you know, anything about the Second World War, very realistic in terms of, yeah, that's what was really happening.
Yeah.
But tracer bullets are a rarity. Mm. Once they know what they're shooting at, you don't fire a tracer bullet because that's traces back to you, doesn't it?
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
And people do die silently. I mean, I witnessed some deaths, but not my lot. Some Argentines, and it's not. There's nothing nice about it. And anyone who says different, you know, and it's a cliche. Anyone who says they were a hero or they witness heroism, it's such a rare thing. Most people, it's just you do things to save your own life and save your mate's life. That's about it. Occasionally, someone will charge forward and take the flak because they've got no choice. If they don't do it, no one else will, and they're all going to die. But I wasn't a hero in any shape or form. I was just in a bloody war.
Surviving.
And you just want to come out of it. All you're thinking about, I can't wait for a snog and an omelette. You know, that's what I want. I want to be home again.
Yeah. I suppose you can't even shoot back, can you, because you can't see.
Well, you don't know what you're aiming at.
No.
You do tend to, your natural instinct is to aim back. But again, what are you aiming at? You can only aim at tracer bullets. Otherwise, you wouldn't know where it's coming from. And they're rare. You know, I would say maybe one in every 80 bullets is a tracer. So, you know, the couple of minutes, you can't, if you're lucky, you happen to see one coming at you, you know where it came from. So everyone's reluctant to fire trace bullets, and even more reluctant to be the one that you have Ren. You know, you're the one firing it. You're telling everybody, guess where I am, mate?
Yeah.
It's leaving a big orange trailer bullet, a tracer line behind it, you know.
Fucking hell.
But anyway,
because I've thought about this a lot. Like, I know people that have accidents and they've accidentally killed somebody.
Yeah.
You were surviving, you had to do what you had to do.
Yeah.
That must just completely change who you are.
Well, it does. And also it makes you regulate your responses. I mean, I don't know if you ever told you this, but there was one time, just going back when Malcolm Hardy and Jane were still together, and her son, I think he was about 14 at the time. I've forgotten his name now, but you know, he had the two boys.
Yeah.
And the girl. This was the eldest of the boys. So there was me, Simon Munnery, Stuart Lee, Malcolm Hardy, Jane, and her son.
Yeah.
After a show, you know, in Malcolm's house, all drinking quite heavily. I was, you know, living local. I lived on a boat in Surrey Quays, just down the road. On the table in front of us was one of these lighter guns. It looks like a pistol, but you pull it, and the flame comes out the top. It's so obviously not a real gun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I know it's not a real gun. Yeah, I'd even used it, so I knew it wasn't a gun. But anyway, James Boy picked it up and went, freeze, like that. And as he did that, my nose just started bleeding.
No.
I know that was my fight or flight response. He's a 14-year-old boy, and it's not a real gun. Mm. But I can't punch him in the face like I wanted to.
Yeah.
Okay, my natural instinct, you just point the gun at me, I should pummel you to a pulp.
Yeah.
And I remember Simon Munnery, well, it all saw it happen, but Simon immediately went, fuck me, you really were in the Falklands, weren't you?
Mm.
I said, "Why? Right, look at your nose." And it was a pressure release, I suppose.
Yeah.
Someone was pointing a gun at me, and you can't go through the motions in your head. Oh, it's a fake gun. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Do you need to get a drink?
I drank a bit of Red Bull, yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you what. So I remember I was at Glastonbury.
Yeah.
And I think I might be working there. And I was selling T-shirts. But I was also, I just started as a barman up the creek. So I knew you.
I knew
you lot. And I remember I'd gone at it, because it was my first proper time at Glastonbury, and I'd gone at it too hard.
Yeah.
And I was off my head. And I was like, right, I need to just go and find some, I know, I'll go to the comedy tent. I'll be able to go and watch that, and I'll know the people, and I'll be able to calm down. And I went in, and you were on, and you were sat. You just sat on the side, on the front of the stage, and you were just chatting like you were just sat at a bus stop. It was amazing. Yeah. And that's when you first heard that. You first did that joke about you getting, you got scuba diving and skydiving.
South Africa.
And I laughed my head off, and I'm like, and it made me feel much better. I said, it calmed me right down.
Yeah, well, I found Glastonbury I've had good and bad there, because you know it depends who you follow, who's on after you, what they're there for. But I mean, I did it for 17 years in a row, and I think I came out slightly on top, not in good ones, maybe five bad ones. You know, generally speaking, it's a nice gig if you capture the moment, you know. And I think that one you're talking about where I sat on the front, I just felt, you know, they're all a bit knackered and haven't had much sleep either. So I can do that. I was, you know, I was sleeping in a tent and a bit knackered. Yeah. And I'm on I think it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon or something, you know. So I went, oh, I don't feel like shouting about and all that. But I did it, and they played along with it, you know. So it can work. But it's judging the time, and the worst one for me is following Bill Bailey. You know, Bill Bailey absolutely rips the roof off him, and then Malcolm says, right, you ready for next act? Nick Wilty, you know. And then,
fuck.
You know. And some acts that are brilliant in clubs are dreadful in that environment. Some people who, you know, are mediocre in clubs are brilliant at that, you know, that they can connect with the hippie audience or the drug takers, the smokers, whatever. And I'm somewhere in between, you know. I met my wife at Glastonbury, but I'd already done 15 Glastonbury before I met her, you know. So I just treated Glastonbury as that's what I did in June, you know.
Yeah.
Funny enough, I've sort of been invited back this year.
Oh, nice.
Not to perform, but just a friend of mine. You remember Bella Churchill, her partner? Haggis, his name is.
Yeah.
Yeah, he came and saw my Falklands show and said, haven't seen you at Glastonbury for years. I said, we haven't been since 2009. We'd love to go back. He said, come this year as my guest. So I'm going to, after I finish talking to you, I'm going to hassle him about that. You know, he said, it was just part of my life. You know, that's what I did. I did Glastonbury, then I did Edinburgh. But of course, you know, marriage and mortgages and all the rest of it gets in the way. It's too expensive to do these things. You know, I did Edinburgh last year, but somebody else put up the money for it, fortunately. But I can't be doing that. I did that for 17 years or longer, actually.
Well, it's all changed now, isn't it? Like back when you were doing it, and all the, I was at the tail end of that era, that when Malcolm Hardy was doing the Sundays at Up the Creek.
That's it, yeah.
So I was at the very last bit of it. But you must have had some incredible times.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard the stories of when Edinburgh was a proper festival.
Yeah,
but now it's just a corporate money making fucking racket.
Look, somebody else put in the money, and I'm thanking public. Yeah. Ron Emsley from ED Comedy.
Yeah,
he said you really should. He knew that I'd found this helicopter I crashed in the museum. Yeah. He said, do a show about it. He said, it hasn't got to be funny. Just do it. And I said, yeah, but I can't go Edinburgh, you know. Month up there, you've got to think about accommodation, food and drink and da-da-da. He said, well, look, I'll throw in a couple of grand, and he did. And it didn't even wipe its own arse, really. It just, there was a loss of, he put in $2,000 and it lost 2,048,
I think.
But I had free accommodation because I was down in Paul Snedden's house, you know, Vladimir.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I bought a camper van with my army pension 8 months ago. So that was my accommodation in his driveway. Everything was fine, you know. Well, they filled up my phone and my drone confiscated by the police who charged me with espionage. But that's all sorted out now. That's they're going to give it all back to me soon.
What? What happened there?
I like flying drones, you know. I used to work in the army, and I've been flying drones for about, well, since they came out, 15, 16 years ago, I started flying drones. So I took my little drone up to Edinburgh, and I was flying it around, you know, just filming stuff. And then, I don't know, 5 days into the festival, I took the drone off down near Princess Street, and this military policeman came up and said, right, bring your helicopter back down. I went, yeah, what's wrong? And he said, we're not allowed to fly here, mate, you know, the castle and that. I said, well, I'm not interested in the castle. I wanted to get views of Princess Street, you know, from afar. And he said, well, you can't fly here anyway. He said, unfortunately, he said, I've had to call the real police. They'll be here in about 5 minutes. And they came along and what? I won't go into it, what happened, but they arrested me under 4 espionage charges. Fucking and they've had my phone and my drone ever since. But apparently, Paul Snedden's daughter, Juliet, picked it up on Monday because they dropped all the charges against me because I pressed 16 charges against them for all the things they did to me.
Yeah.
You know, they absolutely, I mean, they wouldn't let me urinate, for instance. They kept me there for an hour and a half when I really, really, I said, look, I need a wee. I'm on the street in Edinburgh. I need a wee.
Yeah.
We can't go. I said, look, I'm a gentleman of a certain age. I really need to go to
Edinburgh.
They wouldn't let me. They didn't read me my rights. They didn't give me a receipt for the stuff they took. They wouldn't tell me where they'd taken it. They made me open my phone and they copied all my code words. And I said, what are you doing? They said, well, we need to be able to get into your phone. I said, I've just opened it for you. They said, close it again, open it again, put in that same code again. I went, oh, wait, that code's nothing to do with you. I've opened the phone. Well, you know, then they got me. Anyway, it's been an ongoing nightmare. So that ruined Edinburgh for me completely. I had no phone for most of it. And eventually someone gave me a spare phone, and even that was tracked by the police. And up until about 2 months ago, I went into the Apple store. I said, my phone, I said, this is a borrowed phone, by the way. Somebody gave me a phone in Edinburgh, another comedian gave me a phone. I said, and since then, I can't access my own Gmail. Occasionally it tells me I've got a message, but most of the time it doesn't. I said, I can't send text to some people. I said, it's very odd. It keeps telling me I haven't got internet. Yeah, I can get maps on the internet and that, but I can't get, you know, for instance, I can't get the BBC, but I can get American TV. But yeah, I just don't understand it. And this is the Apple store. And he said to me, can I have a look at it? And he took it away and he came back. He said, did you install a VPN on that in August? And I said, sorry? He said, did you install a VPN on there? And I said, no. He said, someone in Scotland put a VPN on there that follows your movements.
Wow.
He said, and restricts your access. So I went, oh, how that's strange, isn't it? Can you remove it? He said, yeah, easy peasy. The moment he removed it, I could get internet, I could get my Gmail, I could get maps, I could do whatever I wanted. So that means from August the 5th last year, right through till 2 months ago, they were tracking my movements, reading every email, every text, all my bank account details, everything. And they've dropped all the charges against me and that kind of them. They've dropped the charges against me.
See, this is the life. This is the life. I don't, you're even when you're doing something fairly innocuous.
Yeah.
You end up with a story. You're fucking.
As I said to the woman there, and the woman arrested me, I said, look, I've got a license to fly. I'm a registered flyer. I'm part of the BMFA, British Motor Flying Association. I said that I'm insured. My drone is under 250 grams, which means I'm allowed to fly over people without their permission because it's so small. I wasn't trying to go over the castle, in the castle. I'm not interested in the castle. Plus the fact I hadn't pressed record. If I'd been trying to record it, you'd have the footage on there. I said, and I'm just someone who, I said, when you look at it back at the police, you'll see we've flown all round Edinburgh. I've been up on Courton Hill, up on Arthur's Seat, and I fly very slowly. I'm trying to get picturesque cinematic views of things. which is what I do everywhere in the world. I take my little drum with me and I try and get, you know, really good, intricate, slow, cinematic footage of good looking places. And that's what I was trying to do that day. That's all I was trying to do.
Yeah.
And she said several things that I can't repeat on here that would have meant she would have been discharged from the police. She told me, she said, I believe that you may have had a payload on there. I said, really? Why would I do that? She said, you could have been dropping a package into and then told me who was in there at the time, which nationality they were. And I said, I don't need to know any of this.
Wow. I'm not interested in that.
And I said, by the way, you know I'm recording all of this. So I had it all recorded on my phone.
Yeah.
So when they confiscated the phone, I said, right, one last thing before you take my phone. I need to send that recording to my other email. She said, so you have two names, you know, Nick Wilty and Nick Pearson.
Yeah.
And she said, two names, two emails. Just coincidentally, you happened to be walking around with a badge on and a picture of a helicopter. I said, my show was about helicopter crashing the Falklands.
Yeah.
That's why I had a picture of a helicopter on there. My poster, though, obviously, behind me somewhere. Oh, there it is up there. But she said, well, I find it very suspicious. You've got two emails. And I remember saying to her, oh, don't worry, I'm in showbiz. Do you think the Great Soprendo is really called the Great Soprendo? Half the people I know up here aren't called what they say they are. It's a stage name. I said, and this show is about helicopters because I found the helicopter I crashed in the museum. That's why I'm doing a show about it. But I've been droning for 20 years as a hobby. I enjoy it. I'm licensed to do it. And she said, I think she said, I don't want to hear the whole story. See you in court. Yeah. So anyway, I then pressed 16 charges against the police generally and her specifically because she had to, reluctantly had to give me her name and number because she was trying to walk away with that. I said, so I don't even know that. You haven't even told me your name, how I'd get hold of you. You don't need to know. I do. You're taking my stuff. I need to know where it's going. You're not entitled to that. Well, how do I get my stuff back if I don't know where it is?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And anyway,
Jesus.
So it resolved itself about a month ago and they sent me a letter saying they are dropping the charges against me.
Yeah.
In light of my presentation, i.e. and had recorded. And, of course, they've got a copy of that recording because it was on my phone. So it's just, it's been an ongoing thing. But actually, as soon as I went into Apple and they told me, I went, right, that's it. Just remove the bloody thing.
Yeah.
So now my phone, I mean, it's a poxy old thing. It's all smashed glass and what have you. And it hadn't got a very big storage capacity. But this was given to me by an Australian comedian because he had a spare one. That's it. So there's nothing suspicious about that phone.
No. But
obviously, the police had installed this VPN on my account. So the moment I logged in to my account, I can't access my own emails. I couldn't get text messages. I couldn't receive phone calls unless they rang me twice in a row. So my wife worked that out now. So I'd say to anybody who wants to go with me, when you ring me, hang up and then ring me again straight away and I can answer. The first time it doesn't ring. Well, it does, but it rings in Scotland first, you know.
Fucking hell.
So, I mean, I could do a whole show about that, but I don't want to give them the pleasure and then they might reopen the charges and say, yeah, I mean, nobody wants to be charged for espionage. Ask Donald Trump.
Mate, this is a lovely way to finish. Thank you, Nick. It's absolutely, I knew this was going to be a good one.
It's nice to talk to you, Rich.
And you, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Insane in the membrane.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Made by darkhorsedigital.co.uk. Shooting, live streaming, and podcast production.